Thank you.
Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. Welcome, everyone. We have a pretty long agenda today, so we'll get started. Sorry for the delay since we just had a late end to session. I know members are still grabbing lunch, and they'll be filtering in shortly. We're going to start with Mr. Galan. Come on up, please, the Director of the Office of Energy Security. And do you want to bring one of your staff with you? It's up to you, and we'll start with the budget presentation, and then after that, we're going to do the quarterly report on what's happening with the stimulus funds.
Madam Chair, welcome
to the committee.
Madam Chair, I'm Bill Galan, Director of the Office of Energy Security, and one of the Deputy Commissioners of the Department of Commerce. If it pleases the committee, what I thought I would do is introduce everybody for the first two items, and then step aside, and Mr. Janke can do the budget presentation, and we could proceed along those lines.
That's fine. Whatever you want.
Madam Chair, Senators, what we're going to do is we're going to present the Governor's budget supplemental budget recommendations for those elements of the Department of Commerce that pertain to this committee. And along those lines, I have with me this afternoon Tim Janke, who's the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Commerce, as well as Diane Wells, who is the manager of our telecommunications division. And we also have some of our staff from the Office of Energy Security who are also available to answer any questions that the committee may have regarding individual budget items. And as item number two, we're going to update the committee on how we've done with the federal stimulus funds that have been entrusted to the Office of Energy Security. And assist with that, we'll have Janet Streff, who's the State Energy Office Director, will make a presentation and will be assisted by Jeremy DeFriebre, who is a supervisor in our State Energy Office. And I also have several other members of our office, including Danny Nadeau and Amy Bisek, who are also here to answer questions on individual projects that we have underway in that area. And with that, I'll turn the proceedings over to Mr. Janke, and I suggest you move to this seat. You might have a little bit more room.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Glan, and welcome, Mr. Janke.
Madam Chair, members, Tim Janke, Department of Finance, Department of Commerce, Financial Management Director. I'm going to go over, I passed out for the committee a one-pager that shows the items in the governor's supplemental budget that fall under the jurisdiction of this committee. And I believe Minnesota Management and Budget provided it to Mr. Mueller previously, so it's the same information. As a bit of orientation on the sheet, the first two columns, the operating budget reductions for 10 and 11 were based on the instructions we received were to look at operating funds, take 3% of the uncommitted dollars in fiscal year 10. So that was not only dollars that were budgeted, but in some cases those funds had been committed for grants or other activities in 10. And in that column as well, the 3% for fiscal year 11 was calculated on the budgeted amounts. The third and fourth columns there for fiscal 10 and 11, respectively, for grants are the same calculation, but 6% of the grant funding, and then there's a total line. You'll note that there was no general fund budget reductions in the governor's budget here for either telecom or for Office of Energy Security. Those accounts or that general fund dollars are fully recovered through the assessment on the utility industries.
Now, Mr. Janke, there are some general fund dollars that the agency has control over that are in the grants area. I know that we've had some grants funded that are still, I presume there's still money left in those?
Madam Chair, there's three accounts that still have some funding, the 85 pump grants, renewable hydrogen, and I'm forgetting the other one right now, but all of those
rebate? That might be gone. Well, maybe not, because they delayed.
The dollars were, we did the calculation for the governor's supplemental budget, but the governor's office didn't choose to include those amounts in the budget supplemental budget.
But it's sitting in someone else's pocket. I'm sorry. So, why did you decide not to go after any of those general fund
areas? Madam Chair, the calculation was done for the inclusion. The governor's office chose not to include those in the supplemental budget. So, but there are funds available in those accounts.
Can you give us the dollar amounts?
We can get that for you.
All right.
I will just start working down the sheet here. The first two items are based on funds available or funds in the TAM account, the Telecommunications Access Minnesota account. The Accessible News is basically just a small portion of that TAM account. In reality, the 128 will fully come out of the TAM account in fiscal year 10, and then 135,000 in fiscal year 11. The TAM account is based on a 6 cent per line per month surcharge on telecommunications bills in the state. The account is there's funds available this year, though we're going to be very close on the cash flow for it at the end of the year, even with these reductions in here for fiscal year 10. And even prior to this, the program was looking at increasing the surcharge because of some other operating costs that were appropriated from the fund last year for OET and some other activities with the legislature. So they're working up that. They're going to have that surcharge recommendation ready for the PUC within the next month or so.
So what's going? When would the surcharge go up?
Madam Chair,
it did go up?
Madam Chair, it would begin July 1st.
Okay, so what happens between now and July 1st if you make this transfer?
Madam Chair, there will be enough cash in the account to, or there should be enough money in the account to get through to that point, and even a little bit into next year as we carry over those funds into next year, and then the surcharge will start accumulating at that point.
So there's no cuts in services that would happen as a result of this?
Madam Chair, it's not expected that there would be any reductions in services.
Okay, and how much would the surcharge have to be raised to make the fund solvent?
Madam Chair, it's unknown at this time. The staff is working on that proposal and getting it ready for the PUCs.
So it looks like on the spreadsheet you're also taking $135,000 in fiscal year 11?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
But that's based on raising the fee.
Madam,
you can't do it unless you raise the surcharge, right?
Madam Chair, they would all be part of that. The equipment distribution portion of the program, as well as the relay service, those costs have exceeded our estimates this year slightly as well. So all of those costs would be included in the proposal that goes before the PUC for approval. So all of those costs would be rolled in as part of that proposal.
Well, I guess what we need to know is, I mean, we need to separate out how much of the fund and how much of the additional monthly charge people are paying is going for those services that we've authorized and required by law, and how much of it would be going to balance the budget. I mean, those are two very different uses of the money. So can you give us that breakdown? Not now, though.
Not now, Madam Chair. Not now, but we can as we prepare the proposal for the PUC.
Okay, but we need to have this information right away because, so we can get our budget done. So we just need to have to understand what the impacts on the consumers would be if we were to take some of this money for budget balancing purposes and how much the surcharge would be raised. And this is for every phone bill, right?
Madam Chair,
state more or less.
Can I have Diane Wells come up and?
Sure. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Diane Wells, manager of the Telecommunications Division at the Department of Commerce. The TAM fee is assessed on every landline and wireless telephone in the state.
So do you have any, it's 6 cents a month now, and do you have any idea of what it would look like next year?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the program had been running a deficit to draw the fund balance down, and with the $600,000 that the legislature approved last year for the Office of Enterprise Technology to make the computer systems for the state more accessible, the $200,000 for the Minnesota Commission for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing for their American Sign Language on their computer systems, and the $200,000, and these are over two fiscal years, to close caption some of the legislative hearings. That $600,000, plus there was a push to do some commercials to get more people to use the CapTel equipment, so that caused a little bit of an increase in over what was expected for the equipment budget. And then the money coming out to balance the budget, all of those things are combining to cause the increase to go into effect, and it goes into effect July 1st with the 911 fee increase that we're expecting. So the telephone companies only have to change the bills once. I would, you know, we're going to make the budget recommendations to the PUC in March, so we're still working on the calculations. I would expect maybe 2 cents. That's just a guesstimate.
Right. And then, yeah, if you can break that down to how much it would be, what would be the implications of this transfer to the general fund would be helpful. Okay. All right. Any other questions for Ms. Wells or on the TAMP funds? All right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, moving on to the next section of the sheet here, there's a number of special revenue funds that the governor's supplemental budget proposes reducing these accounts and transferring those dollars to the general fund to garner savings for the general fund. I'll start walking through those here. The first one is the renewable energy equipment grant account. That would be a $4,000 reduction in fiscal year 10. The funds in that account have come from a small portion of funding that is used for the Weights and Measures Division. It's 81 cents of every dollar of petroleum sold at the wholesale level funds the Weights and Measures program, as well as the renewable equipment grants. And we've transferred $100,000 a year in prior years into here to fund that program. The next account on the list is the Energy Planning and Systems account. Also, the Reliability Administrator is kind of the more commonly used name for that account. That's an assessment on utilities in the state that funds the Reliability Administrator. It's $15,000 in that account. I think the intention is that that amount be termed as expenditures of the fund and then is assessed out to the out to the utilities.
Excuse me, Mr. Janke. Senator yeah. Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Janke, could you tell us on all of these what projects or what activities might not happen if we take the governor's recommendations? In other words, what you might not be able to do had you retained the funds?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, I'll do my best, and if I need some help, I'll have some of the other folks come up. My understanding on the renewable energy equipment grants is that those are that would have a small decrease in grants that are given out to low-income households for renewable energy equipment in their homes. For the Reliability Administrator account, there would be no impact on the program itself, since those funds would be charged out and assessed, so that money would be recouped from the assessment.
Well, which means from our rates that we pay for our electric bill. But it won't be collected. It won't be assessed. And if we don't do this, it won't. That $15,000 wouldn't be assessed. It's not already assessed, is it?
Madam Chair, the funds are already assessed. Okay. They were assessed and collected in here. I think the intention would be that this be termed expenditures of the account and then would be included as an assessment on future assessments.
So this isn't, but this is a one-time.
It's a one-time, correct. The next three accounts, there's two for, they're all SIP-related, the Demand Efficiency Technical Assistance, Demand Efficiency R&D Grants, and then the Facility Energy Efficiency Account. These SIP accounts in total, $641,000 of reduction across the biennium. The amounts are listed here for each of those accounts. The technical assistance account is used more so for funding of positions and staff. And if we need more details on the accounts and the effects, I'd need to get some folks up here to help out. So, Bill, can you? Or Janet?
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Janet Streff. I'm manager of the State Energy Office and the Office of Energy Security. The two line items for the demand efficiency technical assistance and the R&D grants are both in process at this point. The technical assistance money is being used for some smaller grants as we've pulled the program together. It also is funding for staff to run the SIP program. For the R&D grants, we just closed a grant solicitation yesterday, I believe it was. For the last 2 years, we are able to assess utilities for $3.6 million a year for this grant program. $500,000 of that goes to the University Center for Sustainable Building Research for Sustainable Building 2030 activities, so $3.1 million is available. We did not do a grant solicitation last year because our staff were occupied with approving all of the plans that the utilities had submitted so that they could begin their programs January of this year when they are required to save the 1.5% of their annual retail sales and energy savings. And so we had a larger, it was $5.6 million grant solicitation. If this goes through, there would be some projects that would not get funded.
Okay, go ahead.
Can you mention that?
Oh, my apologies. On the facilities energy efficiency or the buildings, the B3 project, that is $500,000 that is assessed and brought into the SIP program, and then we have been providing that funding to the Department of Administration. The Department of Administration and Commerce have worked in partnership for many years to build not only the sustainable building design guidelines, but also a benchmarking tool. This $500,000 a year allows us to continually improve that so that we know how our public buildings are doing. So this, again, would be working with the Department of Administration and the contractors to see what areas we would not pursue.
Madam Chair, moving on to the next group here, there's a number of RDF accounts. It starts from the biogas recovery grants all the way down to the fourth item from the bottom, the U of M grant for the solar lab. All these RDF funds total $406,000 across the biennium, whether that come from operating or grant funds. And again, those the funds saved would be moved to the general fund to garner those savings.
Okay. So did you do 6% on every grant in the Renewable Development Fund?
Madam Chair, for the most part, these are all grants. There are some few operating accounts or operating reductions taken in here, but the bulk of those were all the grants at 6%.
But is that all the grants, or were there some that were spared?
Madam Chair, there were, if in some cases the dollars had been fully expended, there weren't any funds remaining in the accounts. Obviously, those we didn't calculate on. But in the accounts that are identified here, it was any dollars that were budgeted for grants this year, the calculation was performed, and those are included here.
So I don't think you included the Renewable Energy Production Incentive, the REPI. I don't see that on this list.
Madam Chair, I'm not, that question was, came up earlier, and I'm not, to my knowledge, I'm not familiar with that money actually coming into our accounts, but maybe Mr. DeFebri has some information on that.
Okay. Mr. DeFebri, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeremy DeFebri, and I'm with the Office of Energy Security. And Mr. Janke is correct. The renewable energy production incentives are paid directly by Xcel to the recipients. We process applications and notify them of what is to be paid, but it comes directly out of Xcel's fund.
All right. Thank you. And what is the power plant assessment?
Madam Chair, that's the facility siting and routing group that was a former portion of the Environmental Quality Board. They have the ability to assess out for the costs of doing their work. They also bill out for direct costs, so it's similar to our regular gas and electric assessments that we do. So the only portion here is the what's considered the indirect or general assessment for that activity. And those amounts are $11,000 and $15,000 respectively. The next account on the list is a pipeline routing project. That is similar to, it actually is related to the prior account. When that group moved to our agency from the Environmental Quality Board, this funding came with it. That was about five or six fiscal years ago. It's unclear, the statute is unclear whether we have the authority to do this activity or if the funds even should have come with that group to our agency. So we're proposing to just cancel the whole amount to the general fund because it's unclear where the money came from and what we should do with it.
Would the assessments then stop?
Madam Chair, there's no assessment for this account. It's basically the $19,000 that's identified here came with it back in, I believe, like fiscal year 02, and it's just rolled forward since then. The last account on here is the residential propane. There is a fee on liquefied propane in the state. This would reduce the amount of grants in that account by or the amount of money going out to low-income households, $22,000 in fiscal year 10 and $18,000 in fiscal year 11.
Where does that money come from? Is that an assessment also?
Madam Chair, there's a fee on LP gas.
Oh, okay.
That funds this account.
And that's for anybody who fills their tank, their propane tank, gets pays that fee, or how does that get paid?
It's on the sales of propane.
At the wholesale level, or is it?
Madam Chair, yes, it's on the sales of propane, and we'll check to see if it's at the wholesale level or where that tax is applied.
That would be helpful. All right, so I guess I'm a little surprised to see, we hadn't seen the details of these, the governor's proposal, but it looks to me like almost, probably in the range of $1 million of the governor's budget relies on ratepayer money. On your electric bill to balance the budget. I don't think the public is going to be happy to hear that. All right. Any other questions on this list, members? Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just partly because I don't understand all of these numbers. At the bottom of this sheet, we have energy special revenue total, and then we have committee total. What's the difference between these two? Are these we add these together? Or?
Are we asking? Oh, do you want to answer, Mr. Mueller?
Madam Chair and Senator Rummel, the committee total is adding both the revenue that they're counting from the TAM fund, which was $263,000, and then the energy is just a subtotal of that bigger box.
Okay.
So the total that they are transferring as the part of commerce that applies to this division is $1.414 million into the general fund. This would just be a one-time savings. None of these are ongoing.
Okay. Does that make sense, Senator Rummel?
I think.
Answers your question. It's just combining these two things on the page into a total.
So the energy special revenue total is a subtotal?
Yes. It's all the energy-related in the big box.
Mm-hmm.
So just for, to be able to understand the totals. So this is the whole commerce, our side of commerce budget implication.
Madam Chair, that's correct. We've already presented to Senator Tomasoni's committee on the other portion of our agency.
Okay. All right. And so, members, we'll get the information about the general funds that are available in commerce. There's not a lot, but we'll find out what those are in detail. And I guess the other question, what was the other question? I'm not sure if I had another one. Just in general, I guess, and maybe this is for Mr. DeFebri, you don't have to come back, but I know you're here listening. We just would like to get a picture of the Renewable Development Fund. That would help us in our budgeting process so we know what, and we go through this every year, just what obligations exist and what the balances are and how much is what the revenues are in the remainder of the biennium. That would be very helpful. And whenever you can get that to us. All right. If there's no other questions, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. Okay. I guess we're ready for the update. Oh, and I want to mention, I apologize, we don't have enough seats. It's great to have this much interest in our hearing today, so thank you all for coming. Apparently, we can't add any more chairs because of the fire code, and we have to reserve the ones back here for staff and senators. And they are putting, there is a TV out in the hallway with the audio on, but this hearing is not being televised, but you can at least listen to it if you want to go out in the hallway. So sorry about that. We're doing the best we can to accommodate everyone. All right. Now, who are we going to hear from next? Ms. Streff and Mr. Glahn. Ms. Streff, Mr. DeFebri, I think. Okay, great. Ms. Streff.
Good afternoon, Chair Anderson and members of the committee. I'm here today to report on the progress that we've made with the ERA funding for the energy projects. I did bring copies of the quarterly report that we are doing in accordance with the requirements of Chapter 138, so you should have a copy of that. These numbers in this report are through December 31st, 2009. It's also located on our website for everyone else, energy.mn.gov. And then I also have a PowerPoint realized that I did not bring enough copies for everybody, so my apologies. We can certainly
get some more copies made quickly if you
It's certainly up to you. We can certainly post the PowerPoint on our website afterwards as well.
I think we should, because it's going to take a little while to go through. So, thanks.
So the slide number. The second slide, and I realize now I have not numbered them, so going forward this is going to become more of a challenge. But the second slide is looking back a year of hurdles, and I just wanted to have a short reminder or review of what we've done this last year. Just over a year ago, ERA was passed, and we had an understanding of how much money we had to work with, and certainly we worked with you and the committees last year to figure out where the energy money should be spent, and that was decided when Senate File 657 was signed in May of 2009. We worked with the U.S. Department of Energy basically from May until September with getting our grant agreement signed in different stages. They kept adding amendments to it, and that's why we have from July through September. So it really was a process for the U.S. Department of Energy to get started as well.
One of the hurdles that certainly has been in the national news was the Davis-Bacon requirement for all ERA funds. This particularly hit the Weatherization Assistance Program, which historically has been exempt from the Davis-Bacon requirements. Understanding that they needed to meet them brought the realization that there was not a wage classification for weatherization worker. And so the U.S. Department of Labor actually completed, I think, the fastest wage determination in their history. It was about 6 months, where they surveyed every county in the United States and determined the wage classification for a weatherization worker. Minnesota received its wage classifications on September 3rd, which was right before Labor Day. So it was right after Labor Day that we really had a firm understanding those requirements. The last date that I put in there was December 10th, and the other hurdle that we have been experiencing is our compliance with the National Environmental Protection Act. And it came into play as we started to review how we could spend our money on building retrofits, renewable energy projects. We wanted to do projects that we could do quickly so that we could get the money spent that would save energy and generate renewable energy and would not trigger the requirement for an environmental interpretation or even more so an environmental impact statement. So December 10th, we finally received a contract revision that allowed us to go ahead with our state energy program, knowing what particular programs and projects that we could do that would be what is called categorically excluded and would not need an environmental interpretation. We are still awaiting our contract revision for the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant. They should be similar, so we are not anticipating any real delay with that. I wanted to start this time with, last time I spoke first about the Weatherization Assistance Program. This time I wanted to start with the State Energy Program and the Block Grant Program and really tell you about projects that we funded to date, those that are in contract negotiations, those that are on the horizon, so that you'd have a feel for where we are in getting the funding out. Projects funded to date. We started with residential because of the NEPA requirements. So we had two early projects that were quite successful. The Minnesota Housing Finance Agency is one agency that you directed us to work with to create a residential program that was launched in early December. And as it says, 10 weeks after the launch, we've had 609 households across the state that have applied for $2.3 million in rebates, or else they've given notice of their intent to apply. Our grant with MHFA was for $4.4 million, so this is going quite quickly. MHFA reported to us that they have $7.1 million in fix-up fund loans that have been closed, which means the money is in the hands of the consumers and it's ready to pay contractors. Average loan is $11,500. Average rebate is about $3,700.
Ms. Streff, this slide shows a total, the rebate is $4.4 million that we authorized, but the loan amount is a lot more than that. So where does the extra money come in the fix-up loan funds? That says $7.1 million.
That's, Madam Chair, that's from the fix-up fund through MHFA. And the program is that a homeowner needs to apply for a loan, a fix-up fund loan. In doing so, they can access up to $10,000 in grant funds for additional energy efficiency improvements.
So the loan fund is existing dollars, and this is just leveraging those.
That's correct.
Adding to those. So I've seen, I don't usually watch a lot of TV, but I've been tuning in on the Olympics lately, and there's been several ads that I've seen. So do you know where those, who pays for those ads? Is that, I think they're Housing Finance Agency ads probably. They've been talking about this exact program. I don't know if anybody's seen them, but I've seen them several times. and I wonder if that's adding to the...
Madam Chair, we presume that it's part of the fix-up fund budget. They may have done some marketing through administrative funds as well.
But that's not part of your outreach
program? Madam Chair, no, it's not part of the outreach program.
TV commercials? Okay.
No.
Just curious.
The second residential energy efficiency program that we started with was the Builders Association of Minnesota Project Re-Energize, and that again was our office trying to work with the community, trying to get the money quickly into the community, and so we worked in partnership with BAM, with the remodeling industry, with BATSE, to devise a program that has similarities, actually, to what the Energy Savers program became. It was rebates for air sealing and insulation, windows, any kind of change to the home that would make it more energy efficient. As of December 31st, out of a $3 million grant, they have paid rebates of $1.57 million to 748 homes, about $3.50 leveraged for every dollar. 5,641 windows were replaced as well. So that seemed to be one of the more popular items that came out of that program.
Ms. Streff, I'm just going to jump in here because we want to hear jobs created and carbon and other emissions saved. Does that come at the end, or do you have that for each one of these programs?
It comes in just a few more slides, but yes,
right.
We did address that.
Okay, great.
Another project that was funded that had to do with residential energy efficiency was the requirement to provide training for low-income individuals. And we are still somewhat in the process. We have three grantees identified. We have completed the contracting process with two, Red Lake Community Action Agency and partners and Minnesota Valley Action Council and partners. We are completing the contract process with the third grantee. We're hoping that that will be really in the next week or so. The proposals that were provided should the ones that were selected should give us a statewide opportunity to train people. We're asking that training take place at least in Mankato, Minneapolis, Duluth, Bemidji, and Brainerd, other areas in the metro as well. We anticipate at this point going by the contractor's proposals that we should provide training to 360 low-income individuals with that program.
And what is the type of training? I mean, how long is the program, the training program? And
They're varied because the Community Action Agency partnered with groups in their area, but it's all focused on training for residential weatherization, which is why we funneled it through the weatherization assistance programs service providers.
Ms. Trev, did you skip the solar rebates, or did you just say that really fast? It's on the previous slide.
I went right over it.
Okay.
I was having too many page twos up here. Madam Chair, the residential solar rebate program launched only a few weeks ago once we had understood what the NEPA restraints were within that. We are funding photovoltaic, solar thermal, and solar hot air projects. We did have a waiting list of over 55 homeowners and businesses we've had a little bit slower sign-up than we had anticipated. We are hearing from folks that many are waiting for the launch of Xcel Solar Rewards Program, which does start on March 1st. So we anticipate a larger ramp-up once that date comes.
You said there's a waiting list of 5,000?
There were 55 entities on the waiting list when we completed the last solar rebate program, which was from the last RDF fund when $400,000 was appropriated.
Okay, so the RDF rebates have gone out.
Madam Chair, yes, they have.
So there's
they have been
left.
Applied for.
Okay, so that money is... pretty much gone. That's not one of the cuts,
yeah.
Is it? Oh, it is. It was one of the reductions.
Madam Chair, yes, it is.
So, but those grants have already, what's gone out? I mean, is that money committed? Is it spent? Is it out the door?
Madam Chair, the money is committed. The homeowner or small business provides the information. We approve it, and they go on a list so that they know they will have that funding when the work is completed.
So what happens with the cut that's proposed here of $24,000? You counting on us to not do that?
Madam Chair, we did see, and I don't have that number in front of me, but it is a number that may... not all homeowners do go through with it, so there may be some fluidity in that fund. But at this point, it is subscribed.
Okay. Good to know. Okay. So you're not going to like ask people to mail back 6% of their rebate, I presume.
Well, Madam Chair, we will be communicating with the various entities that are contracted so that they understand the budget process that's going on now.
Okay, so, all right. And so the amount that's in the ERA funds for solar rebates, is there enough to meet the demand that you've got right now in terms of people who've signed up?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's $3 million appropriated in ERA funds, so certainly we are nowhere near that at this point.
All right. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Strev, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the solar rebate program. And actually, the questions I got came from a constituent of mine who is a contractor. And he came to me a week or so ago and wanted to know about this program. And I said, I don't know all the details. And I've been seeking an appointment with someone in your office to try to clarify that, but perhaps as long as you're here, you can. I'm looking at page 16 and 17 of this report, and you've got qualifications for contractors. Can you tell me who determined those qualifications? Were these things that were specified in the legislation, or were these things that you or your department established?
Mr. DeFebri?
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, a combination of both. Chapter 138 specify that licensed electrical contractors are required to do the work. That's also part of Minnesota law. The only requirement that would be one that we are providing, I believe, and it is not required. It is it allows one to have a higher rebate level. Is the NABCEP certified installer?
Senator Hand.
Madam Chair, and thank you. That was one of the questions that the constituent that I have raised, questioning the usefulness of that certification and questioning the higher rebate amount that is associated with that. This person was suggesting that that's a certification that costs a significant amount of money to obtain, but the obtaining of it doesn't really, in this person's opinion, do much for providing additional expertise or providing that the system is going to be installed more expertly, or and I don't know the details of that, but his question was, why would you give a higher rebate for this certification when there are significant funds that have to be paid to by contractors to this organization to get the certification, and it's really a very little value? And I, one of the things I wondered is whether that was a part of the legislation or it was a determination that you folks made, and if it was one that you made, what was your, I mean, maybe I'm misunderstanding what my constituent is telling me, but what is the value of this in your opinion?
Mr. DeFebvre?
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, I believe, while I can't go into great detail on it because it's a staff person that is really the expert on this, we do have a differing opinion of the value of NABCEP certification, and not just in the area of solar, but we are looking at what are appropriate certifications for a lot of energy professions as we go down the line. NABCEP, from a programmatic viewpoint for us, provides, we believe that it provides us with greater assurance that we're going to get quality installations, and that has a value in us avoiding issues down the line with systems that we've installed that are not providing the energy value that was anticipated.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Hahn,
and I won't take up too much.
No, I'm just going to say, Senator Hahn, I'm pretty sure the NABCEP, that was not in our legislation, and it was the kind of the solar experts at the department that know more about that.
And Madam Chair, that might be something, and as I said, I'm seeking to put my constituent in touch with someone in the department to learn more about this, and I don't confess to know all the details of solar installation or anything of the sort. But one of the other questions that was raised, though, at least in his understanding, is that these projects were qualified on the basis of how much of the household energy was going to be generated by these installations, that was part of the determination of whether a project were to qualify. I'm trying to remember, it was something, some percentage of the total household energy had to be replaced by the solar installation. Am I correct in that?
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, I will have to check, but I don't believe that is correct.
Well, and Madam Chair, and I'll guess we'll have to defer this, but he showed me some documents that came off of the OES website that specified that certain percentage of energy savings had to be demonstrated, but part of his challenge was that as he's analyzed it, that the practical reality was it would be very, very difficult to install a system that would comply with those expectations. And so he was questioning whether or not that was the intent of this, was to, in his opinion, it meant that there would be very, very few installations that would qualify. So I'm not trying to put you on the spot here if you don't have the responses to this. As I said, I want to try to pursue this maybe with my constituent and someone in your office offline to understand this better. But I thought as long as you're here, I'd try anyway. So thank you.
Ms. Treff.
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, your aide did call me, and we are setting something up. So
okay.
It's good to have this as a basis. I will say that while we do review the rebate program when we do get new funding, it has not changed dramatically over the years. So, but we will come prepared to discuss that.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead, please.
We launched another project funded today, residential ground source heat pump rebates. That program was launched on February 16th. We have had a very strong response. At least $500,000 of funding has likely been reserved in the first week. We still are going through some of the proposals to make sure that they meet the qualifications. This ground source heat pump fund included small wind and ground source heat pumps. So we are looking at, I think $2 million had been appropriated for that. We set aside $1 million for each as to start out. So we then came to $500,000 for residential. So we are still working to see what the best distribution of funding may be to get the money out and the work done. We hope to release a commercial ground source heat pump rebate program soon. Currently, because of the NEPA categorical exclusions, the largest size for heat pump is 5.5 tons. But we are taking conditional rebate reservations because we have been hearing that the U.S. Department of Energy may be increasing that dramatically. So we, if somebody is coming to us with a possible option, we're at least getting their name and having them reserve at that point.
And, Mr. Struff, 5.5 tons, that doesn't mean – I have no idea what that means in terms of scale. Is that like a typical residential-size system or not?
Madam Chair, that is – I think most of the applications we're seeing for residential are slightly smaller than that, but I believe DOE set that as what they thought was a typical upper end for a residential scale. So that's why we're somewhat – concerned about do we offer small business rebates at a time where it may be no small businesses may be able to take advantage of it while we're sitting on money that could be going to residential applications.
Okay.
The next program that we've funded that will be kicking off on March 1st that everybody in the room should be aware of, and that's our appliance rebate program, the Minnesota Trade-In and Save. We have $5 million going to this program. It will launch on March 1st at 8 a.m. You need to get a reservation from MinnesotaAppliancerebate.com. You apply, get the reservation, and you have, I believe, 30 days to then purchase the appliance and get your rebate. We are going with white goods, so it's refrigerators, freezers, clothes washers, and dishwashers. For refrigerators and freezers, you get an additional amount if you recycle your refrigerator or freezer. So it's $100 for refrigerators with another $100 for recycling. Freezer is $50 with another $50 for recycling. $200 for a clothes washer and $150 for a dishwasher. We believe there'll be about 250. We believe there will be 25,000 rebates available. And households are limited to one appliance rebate. All of the appliances need to be Energy Star labeled. And again, it's mnappliancerebate.com, March 1st at 8 a.m. That was my advertisement for the day.
Yeah, very good. I bet there'll be a lot of interest in that.
The commercial industrial project that we funded to date is we did determine that St. Paul Port Authority, along with Xcel Energy, met the requirements of the language. We have contracted with St. Paul Port Authority for $5 million. They are currently selecting entities that are in all of Xcel's territory and are looking at which bring the greatest energy savings, which are meeting all the historical preservation standards and such, and will be moving forward as soon as they get through that phase. Then moving on, programs that are in contract negotiation. We've gone through the RFP process and have come down to some specific ones. The outreach activities to increase residential participation has taken far longer than it should. We are in final negotiations with three entities. It will cover the state, and that contract should be completed. We have three program managers now, one working on each contract, so it should be very soon. The next one is emerging renewable energy industries. We had 26 proposals. We have six proposals that we are currently in contract negotiation with. And, again, that's moving forward fairly quickly and hope to get those in place very soon.
Yeah, I was wondering. What size grants did you put out on the RFP that?
For the emerging renewable?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, we allowed them to be up to $1 million.
But there was only $2 million total. So you came up with six. That would be sharing it?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Senator Rummel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have any idea when those names or the companies would be public?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, it likely will be at least a month, because we still have to get those presented to USDOE, get NEPA review on that by them.
Thank you.
Go ahead, please.
We are working with the State Department of Administration to provide them with funding so that they can do their state government building retrofit program. They have already started their the preparation for their program, and at the end of 2009, they had 10 applicants in the program, which brought them 190 buildings and 4.9 million square feet. And that was at the end of 2009. We expect that to be, again, in the next week or two, that interagency agreement will be finished. We also determined for the Innovative Energy Residential Efficiency Program and the Small City Energy Efficiency Grant that Duluth and Park Rapids were the cities that met the requirements set out in Chapter 138. We are completing negotiations with the City of Duluth right now. The scope of work is being determined with Park Rapids, but Mr. DeFebri has met with both of them multiple times. And finally, again with the biomass energy facility, we determined that Chisago County was the entity, and that contract should be complete next week. We have a couple programs that are currently in RFP status. There is an error on the first one, which is energy programs in commercial, industrial, and 501c3 nonprofit buildings. The RFP did close in February. We had over 300 proposers file a notice of intent, but I was told after I printed this that we had somewhere in the neighborhood of 145 proposals that came in and that are under review in our office. So it's 145, not 300 plus, under review.
And I'm trying to remember, this was this the non-XL program for the rest of the state?
Madam Chair, that's correct. It was,
and it was statewide. I can't really remember that.
It was statewide. It was also for energy efficiency and some renewable energy.
Okay.
It did not
pretty open,
but it was commercial, industrial, and nonprofit.
Okay, so there's a lot of interest.
Yes. The next program that's in RFP that I can't talk much about is we do have the 60% of the EECBG money that we received that needs to be a competitive grant to the smaller cities and counties. Those proposals are due March 3rd. So what is up next? We're working on the remainder of the EECBG money and some state energy program money to move forward with building retrofits for local units of government and school districts. We also will be putting out an RFP for the renewable and commercial energy efficiency training for low-income and disadvantaged individuals. There is up to $1 million was stipulated in Chapter 138 for that, and we think that will happen in mid-April. We have been very busy, and it's to me been an interesting development with the training and workforce development component that you put into Chapter 138. We've been working with MNSCU and DEED, are creating a statewide training implementation plan, figuring out how to ensure that there are jobs created before we train too many people. And as we began to look at that, we also saw that there weren't very many career pathways. What do you need to do to get to a certain job or occupation? And so we are creating career pathways in both renewable energy and energy efficiency. As this slide says, we're partnering with them to construct an asset map so that we know what DEED is doing, what the Workforce Development Board is doing, what MNSCU is doing in training, what Dunwoody or Summit Academy is, so that we don't miss something and overdo it in another area.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you give us an example of what you career pathways that you're looking at developing?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, Currently, the only career pathway that we saw that was developed for the state was in ethanol. And so it talked about it, it's a little brochure almost as how they've distributed it, but it shows the different positions that are in ethanol and the money that one might make at it and also what kind of education is needed. So we plan to do something for wind, solar, whether it's solar thermal or PV. With energy efficiency, there are even fewer examples, actually, and so it's in residential, it maybe is a little more easy to figure out that it might be energy auditor or insulator. In commercial energy efficiency, there is some recommissioning, but they usually just say professional engineer, and we're finding that a lot of professional engineers get their PE, but they don't necessarily focus as much on what needs to be done to make something energy efficient. So there may be a new career pathway to some job like that. So those are the kinds of things that we'll be doing.
Thank you.
You know, I've been hearing about the apprenticeship programs and the fact that there's not hardly any of the weatherization programs are using them. And it seems to me that should be part of your career pathway, is looking at apprenticeships to get into the trades, into the skilled trades.
Madam Chair, we are working quite closely with the apprenticeship programs, finding that there's not a particularly good listing of the apprenticeship programs in the state at all, and so we are working with them to perhaps develop something that's fairly cohesive. So, yes, we see that as a gap.
Senator Bach.
Oh, Madam Chair, if we can't find a good listing of the apprenticeship programs, I'm sorry, but they're all registered over at the Department of Labor and Industry. The department has a huge list of all the apprenticeship programs of everyone is registered with the state. Every apprentice in the trades is registered. Every program is registered. I refuse to accept that answer that we cannot find a list.
Ms. Streff.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, there is a listing at Dolly, and we have been working with Dolly to see what kind of information they have and how it might apply to the career pathways that are in EERE.
Madam Chair, the problem we have, and I just can speak for the carpenters, 3 years ago the carpenters had 1,200 apprentices working. Today they have 300 because there is no work. There's simply no work. They cannot put new apprentices in because they can't keep the ones they have working, can't keep the journeymen they have working. I mean, the construction industry is in very dire straits. And I don't understand this whole career pathway thing. I mean, we have apprenticeship programs over at Labor and Industry that are, many of them are over 50 years old. And it might do all of us some good to take and tour some of the apprenticeship schools that exist, that the trades run, that they put a lot of money into. There is a very good career path for people who want to go into the trades and very, very good private facilities that train people. I don't understand all this duplication, all this bureaucratic paper that we're all moving around when the private sector is putting huge money into apprenticeship. I just know in the case of the carpenters, it's about for every man hour that's worked in Minnesota in the carpenter trade, under a union contract, they put around 40 cents an hour. Every journeyman, every apprentice, I mean, it's real money. Just in the Twin Cities here, the Twin City carpenters, prior to the recession, were working over 1 million man hours a month. That means they were putting $400,000 a month into their apprenticeship school to train apprentices. There is a lot of stuff going on in the private sector here and has been for decades. And somehow, because we get a little federal money, we think we can create some new career paths. I don't even understand what we're talking about, and I've been in the trades all my life.
Ms. Streff.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, we have been working with the unions. We've toured their facilities, and we're trying to work with them to mesh the jobs that we think may be created in energy efficiency and renewable energy so that they're unions can do that work. So we are working with them. And I I agree. My husband has been out of work for over a year. He's in construction, so I'm quite aware that we have a lot of work to do.
Well, Madam Chair, I thought the legislation we passed said something like, to the extent possible, these programs should utilize existing apprenticeship programs.
Yes, it did.
And I'm pretty unsure that that's happening, that anybody's actually making an effort to execute the legislative intent here.
I think we might have said that specifically in the weatherization part. I don't know. Maybe we said it. We probably said it in the rest of the bill, too. I don't recall for sure, but we probably said it in several places. In any case, it's one thing to be figuring out the pathways and sort of what we're going to do in the future when we have more jobs available, but the money that we have delivering right now across the state, I'm hearing that, too, that we're just not implementing apprenticeship programs in the delivery of these dollars. They're just not happening. There's a few folks who do it already, and they're continuing to do it, and nobody else is really hiring apprentices and using them. And that is what we said. We said to the extent possible, and that means you try every time. You know, you try as hard as you can. So we haven't gotten to the weatherization. I don't know if we have that on your specific agenda to talk about that, but I've definitely been hearing those reports on the weatherization program. Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, at the beginning of this presentation, the second slide had to do with vacant wage determinations for weatherization workers, and it was mentioned that the federal government some months to figure this out for every county in or every state. What is a weatherization wage? Prevailing wage in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Senator Dill, it varies by county, which is why they had to do a county-by-county survey. And prevailing wage is typically done on a county-by-county basis, is my understanding.
Do you have any range or wage that you
can Madam Chair, Senator, I don't, but I could easily get you the numbers quickly.
And Senator Dill, on the apprenticeship side, if you bring in an apprentice, you can pay them a lower prevailing wage rate. So it's a way to actually bring in workers at a lower price and get them into the, you know, into the job and the training and the opportunity, but at a little bit lower cost. So that's another reason we should be doing that as much as we possibly can. Senator Dill.
Well, Madam Chair, Mr. DeFebre, what I'm worried about is the issue brought up in conference committee about not allowing people to work in the weatherization business, use these federal funds if
they have some kind of a blemish on their record, a felony conviction or misdemeanor conviction of something like that. Are these people being screened out so that they're not given an employment opportunity because of some mistake they made in the past?
Madam Chair, Senator Dill, most of our service providers, if not all of them, have historically done a background check before they hire employees, but there was nothing additional, to my knowledge, that was put in.
No, we didn't accept any of those additional requirements, Senator Dill, thanks to you, and you helped us. And
we didn't eliminate the ones that already employed.
No, we did not. And the CAPS testified that they routinely do that, and we're going to hear from them later, so you can find out what their, you know, what that process consists of, if you'd like.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Streff.
Staff just informed me that the prevailing wage across the state for weatherization workers is ranging from $12 to $22 an hour.
Senator Bach.
Well, Madam Chair, on that subject, is there any requirement of the filing of payroll reports so that somebody is, who's monitoring that information, or where is it collected? Saying we have one is one thing, but actually having some compliance initiative, I'm just curious how that's being done or if it's being done.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Streff.
Yes, it indeed is being done. With Davis-Bacon, there are certified payroll sheets that need to come in on a weekly basis on all workers that are doing work, construction work over $2,000. They're coming into our office. We are accumulating them, reviewing them. It's hundreds of them. And right now we're creating a system where we're scanning them in so that we have an easier way to work with them.
Senator Bach.
And then, Madam Chair, is that public information? I mean, could I, if I decided I wanted to look at them, or if somebody in the public wanted to, how would they access them if they felt somebody was not being paid the correct rate? Is there a process?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, yes, there is a process. We are going through that process right now with one Freedom of Information Act. It because it is a Department of Energy requirement, it becomes not a Minnesota data privacy component, but a federal Freedom of Information Act, and so the request needs to go through the U.S. Department of Energy. They then contact us, and that's one reason that we are making them available in an electronic format so that a group can more easily access them and go through them.
Senator Bach, Ms. Doyle has been communicating with the attorneys at Commerce to try to make sure that these records are available and are made, you know, accessible to the public as soon as possible.
But so, Madam Chair, they're not available yet? If I wanted to see some?
Apparently not.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, it is a Freedom of Information Act request that needs to go through the U.S. Department of Energy.
And if I, Madam Chair, if I indicated that I wanted to see them, would the department or somebody direct me where to go, or what happens when we get a request?
Madam Chair, the Department of Energy contacts us, and we will then be instructed as to whether we provide that information or not. We would then allow that person to come to our office and look at the originals if they chose. They could receive a CD, or we're hoping even go to an FTP site and retrieve them at that place.
All right, thanks. All right, why don't you continue?
So on the horizon, we be dependent upon NEPA reviews and decisions. We will be putting together a renewable energy grants program for local units of government and school districts that may be wanting larger renewable energy projects. I know Mr. DeFebri has been meeting with Solar City's staff, and so that one is still on the horizon. We just saw that a U.S. Department of Energy grant solicitation is coming out on creating an energy efficiency training center, and so we may be able to work with that grant solicitation and actually also provide our funding and come up with something there. I then move towards the Weatherization Assistance Program, if I may. Where we are today with the Weatherization Assistance Program, at the end of the quarter, December 31st, we had 1,392 completions. By the end of January, we had 2,019 completions, so we are still ramping up and becoming quicker and better at what we're doing. We also wanted to show that we haven't just been waiting, and so you see that during that same time period there were 1,659 regular DOE completions with the money that we get from our regular contracts. So in total we have almost 3,700 completions by the end of January, and we estimate that there's at least another 2,300 that are in some type of progress of completion, at least having gone through the initial audit. There are some slides coming up. The next slide is, I think, a pretty good description of how the ERA money has been, which is the grayer line, not the darker line. The lighter line is the ERA, and how that has been increasing since September. The next few slides are in answer to some of those eight questions in the accounting and transparency section. Um, There was a request to let you know what kind of dwelling types were used, and so we've provided a breakdown. Certainly the largest are the site-built owners, but almost 15% have been rental units.
And has there been any, and we can ask the CAPS this too, but if they've looked at any shelters? I think Senator Vickerman helped us on that, but there was a process with the federal government to make sure that was, I think there was maybe a waiver that had to happen.
Madam Chair, the waiver was not for shelters,
oh,
I believe.
For
there was a rulemaking for multifamily where DOE was working more closely with HUD. The rule is completed and actually I think went into effect yesterday. We are working quite closely with MHFA to see how we can better use the weatherization money in conjunction with their money that they, their HUD money that they use for multifamily, to make sure that we're getting as many multifamily as we can. Our service providers are right there with us. So we should see an increase in that now that the rule has been met. As far as shelters go, I noticed that we didn't have any in the first quarter, but I do know of a couple of service providers that did have shelters planned for weatherization. There was a requirement for I think there was a requirement. If not, here's some information. For the annual income for the weather era weatherized households, so you can see the largest sector, 40% had an annual income from 10 to 20,000. The next slide shows program expenditures for era weatherization, and this again was for number two, asking for income on the weatherization measure that was installed. And we certainly, I think we installed insulation in all of them. But you can see the breakdown. Mostly air sealing, insulation, and furnace installations are the largest segments that we did spend money on. For the slide that shows where we are today with jobs created or retained, it's been an interesting method of calculation that the office, U.S. Office of Management and Budget has required. They require us to report how many jobs are created or retained based on FTEs. So it's not possible to add the quarters up. So we have each quarter that gives us a snapshot of how many FTEs, how many man hours were spent with ERA dollars. So you can see there was quite an increase from our October report to our January report from the weatherization program, which was 169.5 to 346.48. And I'm looking at this, and I'm sure that 7.1 is for SEP is an erroneous number, because we did have Project Reenergize workers, and I know that went up in the range of 36 or 37, so we will need to correct that number.
How many of these are Commerce employees?
Madam Chair, I should have the exact number. We are on target to about double our staff. We had 19 people in the State Energy Office, and we were adding 19 or 20, and I apologize, but I have not done the count recently. We did the most ramping up in our weatherization assistance program, hiring 7 field monitors so that we could inspect 10% of the houses rather than the 5% that's required. I can get you the number of man hours or FTEs for our office, though, fairly easily, but I don't have that with me.
Ms. Streff, I'm going to ask you to try to conclude because we have a lot of other people who wanted to testify. So if you could sort of
Madam Chair,
that would be great.
My pleasure. The energy savings, again, we received the most energy savings in the weatherization assistance program. Project Reenergize was the other program that was going during this quarter, and certainly because it was a smaller program, not as many MBTUs. The funds encumbered or committed slide is small, hard to read. I wanted to let everybody know, however, that it encumbered certainly is exactly what it says. Committed, however, we wanted to get an idea of what monies and programs did we have that were in RFP status, that were in contract negotiations. The numbers that we knew we were going to be committing, doing something with very quickly. So that's what encumbered and committed means. Leveraged funds, again, this was through the end of December, and so we are leveraging even more every day. Project Reenergize was, I think I said $3.50 before. Here we've got $4, so this might be newer numbers, but it's been a good program. Training. In the report, there's quite a listing of the training that's gone on. 750 weatherization trainees, multiple days of training there. Certainly BAM and Minnesota Green Star and others did almost 1,000 train for their program in a short amount of time. And then the compliance requirements. It ended up as mostly qualitative information. There's some very good comprehensive summaries in the back, and I would ask you to look at those. And finally, I just wanted to mention that we are also working with a grant that's ERA money for energy assurance activities that is allowing us to work more closely on our energy emergency plan with the Homeland Security folks in the state, and also coordinating a regional effort to make sure that the FEMA 5 region states are tracking together so that smart grid activities can be coordinated, so that transmission activities are coordinated, so that we really have a grid that's not just good in Minnesota, but that's resilient in the entire region. And with that, I will close.
Thank you, Ms. Streff. I'm looking for some report on our hiring goals, specifically about reaching out to disadvantaged communities. And I see, it looks like your slide is referring us to the report for that information. I'm glancing at the appendix, but
on page 27, we highlighted the great work that the 6 metro community action agencies did. They developed a request for proposals. They received 65 and had a final pool of 63. In the end, they had 17% were minority contractors, 16% were women-owned businesses. We asked each agency or service provider to report, and they did in different ways, which why, as I said, it was more qualitative. But by county community action had contracted in 18 different areas and had many who met the eligibility requirements. Otter Tail Wadena has a female and a disabled, a minority contractor. Prairie 5 reported new hires that were Hispanic. So each of their reports goes into a little more depth. I would be pleased to work with you to figure out a better way to get at the information that you required. It was it was difficult to hone in on how, what kind of question do we ask them to get to all of the compliance in hiring disadvantaged workers, veterans.
Okay. Well, at least we have some. We have more than we had in your first report, and it's so I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And that's progress, and we'll talk to the CAPS about that a little bit too. All right. Thank you so much. Are there any other questions? Okay. Thank you for your time. We appreciate it. And members, there are a lot of people who would like to speak and testify, so we'll try to give them our full attention and as much time as possible. We'll start with Arnie Anderson from the Community Action Partnership statewide. And are you guys all coming up together? Clarence Hightower from Ramsey, Washington. Yeah, come on up. Bill Davis, is he still here? I thought I saw him. Oh, good. Okay. And then I see Dan Newman. This is a group listed on by Don Jarofsky. So, yeah. Who's with us in spirit. That's right, in sneeze. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and Senators, thank you very much for this opportunity to present today. My name is Arnie Anderson. I'm the director of the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. We're the statewide association of community action agencies. Today we have Mr. William Davis, the president and CEO of Community Action of Minneapolis, and Mr. Dan Newman from Sustainable Resources Center, which is the service provider for the suburban Hennepin area. We had hoped that Mr. Hightower would be able to join us today. He happens to be involved in collective bargaining negotiations, and apparently he was unable to make it, at least at this time. So with that very brief introduction, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Davis.
Sure.
All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Davis, and I'm the President and CEO of Community Action in Minneapolis. And I'm pleased to have the opportunity to share with you some of the questions and response that you asked at the last committee meeting, specifically with respect to the workforce demographics. We find it relatively easy to extrapolate that information. I can't speak for my colleagues, but it seems to me if we receive the kind of instructions that this committee has outlined in the past, it seems to me that that was fairly clear and straightforward. And I can't tell you why that wasn't communicated and received effectively. But I can share with you that we've, in our workforce, we have over 61 either retained or new hires for the weatherization crew. Of that group, 70% were Caucasian, 13% African American, 10% Latino, 5% Native Americans, and 2% Asian, and 8% were women in our workforce. We have about 27 crews that we actually have out and about working on this project. One-third of our workforce is also union. So we've tried to do the kinds of things that we felt that this program was designed to offer. Obviously, it is always more that can be done, but this is, we feel, is a great starting point. In terms of our mechanical workers, the ones that replace our furnaces, again, we have 5% African American, 3% Latino, 1% Native American, and 1% other minority, and 15% of them are women, and 9% are veterans. So again, these information is readily available, and we had no problem whatsoever meeting the request of this committee to make this information available. I did need to point out that we did not receive funding, and the funding that we did receive was 50% until August, which is about 6 months ago. As a result, we have been able to we have a goal of 12,000 homes to be weatherized by June of this year. We have completed 362 of those homes. We have another 583 audits that have been completed and ready to go. We will be assigning those tasks to our crews very soon. It's important to point out that while the calendar does click and it shows that we've been at this for 6 months, There's always a slowdown during the holiday season, particularly during the Thanksgiving and Christmas season. It's not so much that we're not available to go out, but some of the homeowners are actually reluctant to have people come in around that time of the year to disrupt their plans or their activities with respect to the holidays. So we respect that. We've also been told by our crews that they've had an extra burden with the increase in snow that we've had. Nothing like certainly the East Coast or some other parts, but the snow creates a hindrance around the perimeter of the house that the crews often have to go and shovel to make a pathway all the way around the home in order to put their scaffolding and other equipment up to be able to complete their job. So there is some slowdown as a result of those kinds of things when we're working. We also want to point out that half of our weatherization activities have also been dedicated to rental units. That's something that we wanted to try to do a better job of to reduce energy consumption in rental units. We haven't done any of the large-scale multifamilies at this time, but we do anticipate ramping up this summer as we go full bore with all of our activity as the weather warms up. So we hope at the next cycle that we'll be able to share with you even more glowing report in terms of our progress and our effectiveness in terms of hiring people, getting people homes weatherized, and things of that sort. And then also, one of the questions that was brought up with respect to the payroll reporting, I just want to point out, in our situation, in our agency, not only do we require the payroll documentation, but we also have hired another individual specifically to go out to spot check the homes that we've done, make sure that, in fact, the crew representation is there and that the payroll is actually accurate so that we don't have people manipulating that information and submitting information that may not be as accurate as possible. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks and entertaining questions at the appropriate time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Davis. Did I hear you say 12? You're going to do 12,000 homes?
No, 1,200.
1,200. All right. I was getting really excited there. Boy, if we get 12,000 in Minneapolis alone.
Well, if you give us more money, we'd think about it.
Well, hey. We'll see what we can do there. What about apprenticeships? Do you have any apprentices on the job?
Madam Chair, at this time, we do not hire we hire contractors who then turn around and hire their crews. We encourage them to use both apprentice as well as union. We do pay Davis-Bacon prevailing wage. So regardless of whether they're union or non-union, they still have to pay the individual the prevailing wage.
All right. Who's Mr. Newman? Sorry.
Hi.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Newman. I'm the Executive Director of the Sustainable Resources Center. We're a healthy homes nonprofit organization and the weatherization program for suburban Hennepin County. Not to take too much of your time, just a couple of things that have not yet been mentioned I'd like to bring up. One is, many of you may have seen yesterday's New York Times article talking about the difficulties with weatherization across the country. I'd like to note that between Mr. Davis's organization and my own, we've weatherized more ARA units than the state of New York or the state of Illinois. So we're doing pretty good.
That's great. Yay. Well,
thank you.
Members, we should I don't know if anyone's mentioned the award that came from DOE, so maybe you could just mention that to
the members. Yes, the state of Minnesota Department of Office of Energy Security and the agencies doing weatherization received an award from the Department of Energy for being one of the top five states in getting ARA implemented and getting weatherization done. So that was quite a feather in our cap and a testament to the cooperation between the state and the CAP agencies and all of the contractors and weatherization workers doing the work. So we're putting people to work and we're getting houses insulated. One more thing I'd like to say about the multifamilies. We have not traditionally done multifamily because of the limitations on the programs. We're looking to do that. Our staff have been trained so that we can do the audits. We've got the software we need. We're waiting for an agreement, a list to come out of the Department of Energy and HUD that says that these particular projects are certified, because the alternative to that is going through and individually certifying each resident of those properties. So once that list is out there, we're prepared to move ahead on that, and we think that'll move fairly quickly. One thing I'd like to note about the conditions of the homes that we're going into is that we have found very high health and safety needs in those homes. Under the Department of Energy program, we're allowed to spend $1,000 a unit on health and safety. And we can use also utility company money and other dollars that come through the EPWAC transfer to address health and safety programs, health and safety needs. We've talked to some other weatherization agencies, and they're finding similar needs. We're averaging almost $2,000 a unit for things like smoke detectors, CO detectors, furnace repairs, furnace replacements, water heater repair or replacement, mechanical ventilation, and other things having to do with the safety and health of the people in the house. That does a number of things. One, it makes it a healthy environment for the people living there and all of the benefits that come from that. Two, it sustains people in very low-income people in their housing, allows them to stay in those homes, and, of course, it saves a lot of money in the long run. But it does show the state of the housing we're going into and the other needs that housing has and how we're addressing not only weatherization needs but really the sustainability of those properties for low-income people. And that's all I have to say. Thank you. I'll take any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Newman. Do you have any apprenticeships in your programs?
I do not believe any of our contractors have apprentices. We also contract out all of our weatherization work through the RFP process that Ms. Streff described.
It's frustrating when we put something in law and then we hear, well, we encourage it, they encourage it, but nobody's doing it. And so that's very frustrating to hear that. And, you know, we would really like to see more efforts put into that area. But thank you for what you are doing, and we appreciate that. Mr. Davis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to share with you, I gave you a total of 61 in terms of new hires or working on the project, but overall we've added 109 either new or retained employees to this project.
All right. That's a lot of jobs. Can I ask, I see all the people in the room with hard hats and vests, and maybe could people – thank you.
All right. Thank you.
I guess we're – yeah, there's no other questions for the CAPS. Thank you so much for being here. Let me just ask, as we're letting Mr. King come up or the next panel, how many folks in the room are working now in this – in one of these – weatherization programs or related jobs? Oh. How many would like to be? Oh, wow. Okay. And those of you who have your hands up, how many of you are out of work now? Wow. All right. And how many of you are in a training program now? Okay. Well, that's – thank you for the information, and good luck to all of you. Yeah. Thank you for being here, too. So let's take our last panel, Mr. King, Mr. Bauer, and a student whose name I do not know. Apologize. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, as always, for the opportunity. Thank you, Senators. To my left is Lewis King, who is the President and CEO of Summit Academy OIC, the training location of many of these great students that are in the room today. And at the end of the table is Michael Lee, who is a graduate of Summit Academy OIC, who's now out there trying to get one of those good green jobs, and so he's going to speak just very briefly.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. So just to remind the committee, we know many of you quite well after many long hours in hearing rooms just like this. Higher Minnesota is a coalition of over 70 organizations. We came together at the end of 2008 to make sure that public investments in infrastructure and renewable energy did three things. One was create jobs that could lift people out of poverty. One was to reduce racial inequity, and one was to build healthy communities for everybody. And so we were here a lot last session. We had a lot of great discussions, and we ended up with Senate File 657, which was a bill that we were all very proud of. It took a lot of hard discussions, but good relationships built with our friends in the Carpenters and the CAPS and all kinds of other stakeholders. And so if you remember, we had three objectives in this piece of legislation. One was training opportunities, like the ones that these folks are getting to get into these jobs. One was reporting and accountability, which is the reason we're here today. And one was outreach to communities about these opportunities. And so Mr. King's going to talk to you a little bit about the training piece. I'm going to spend just a couple minutes on outreach and reporting, if that's okay. But first, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Lee for some brief comments.
Great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Is it Lee?
Yes, Lee.
All right. Welcome.
My name is Michael Lee. I'm a graduate of Summit Academy OC. I'm a qualified and trained individual to do weatherization and also apprenticeship in carpentry. I was asked to speak to ask you guys to make jobs for the students that you see on the side here, to give them an opportunity to be successful inside the community and also in the workforce field. I also ask that you guys take in consideration that all the hard work that Higher Minnesota and also Summit Academy is doing to train the individuals so that they can be employed and have the skills and the qualified skill setting that the employers may look for. So that's basically what I'm here to ask, and I thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lee. Any questions? Well, good luck to you, and congratulations on your progress that you made through training. So now we just got to get more of those jobs out there.
Madam Chair,
Mr.
members,
King, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me today. I'm Louis King, President and CEO of Summit Academy OIC and a member of Higher Minnesota. First, I want to thank you for your support last year, which enabled us to get legislation passed that would afford opportunities to people that I represent. The community that I represent in Minneapolis, people of color poverty rates begin at 25%. For African Americans, we're at 45% prior to the economic downturn. So we view this as an opportunity to help folks gain skills and get jobs. We've formed some great partnerships with SRC and the Minneapolis CAPS. In a few days, we should have our training agreement in place with OES, and we look forward to receiving those funds. Up to now, though, Summit has trained over 100 people, basically on our own dime, but we're committed to it. Secondly, I want to commend Janet Streff and her staff for the work that she's done with our people and Bill Means of the State Council, OIC, to develop a planning program for weatherization with the tribal nations, Red Lake, Mille Lacs, Leech Lake, and White Earth, and we just put that into place in Summit, and the OIC State Council will be partnering with those folks to bring the expertise to them as well. So this has been progress, but nevertheless, my friend Dan Newman mentioned the New York Times article yesterday. I had the dubious distinction of having an ABC interview and having to report only 7 of my people have gotten jobs. And in my conversations with Mr. Davis, we understand that that they're turning the corner and it was slow getting off, start again, things like having to certify 3,000 counties based on the prevailing wage and some of the other things, and just watching this thing were incredible to see unfold. There have been disappointments, though. Remarks in the press from folks that they did not see this as a jobs program, even though they were responsible for implementing the law. I learned a long time ago in undergrad at street level, bureaucrats sometimes gets the final vote, and we may be witnessing that in some terms right now. In addition, for some reason, the folks of Ramsey County and St. Paul were not able to participate in the training competition that OES put on the streets. And so because of that, people east of the river basically don't have training options. Finally, I'd like to close by pointing out that we are friends of labor. Prior to the ink being dry on the paper, we negotiated agreements with the carpenters to ensure that adequate participation was there for people of color and the folks from those communities. However, they understood that we could not stand on the sidelines as we saw other workforces come in while our people were unemployed. And we are also in discussions with the electricians to develop a program so that will be an access for those renewable energy jobs, even though the market is underdeveloped at this time. I concur with Senator Bach. The career ladders are there. They have been defined. The real issue for us, and we're working at this with our friend Harry Melander and others in labor, is we understand there's a downturn now. However, we must keep our eyes on the long-term horizon where we're facing workforce shortages because of an aging demographic in that population. Thank you for allowing me to speak to the committee today, and I'll take any questions whenever you have them.
Thank you, Mr. King. Why did the East Metro get shut out of the training dollars?
Madam Chair, that would be an appropriate question for Mr. Clarence Hightowers or his representatives if they're present.
And I'm not sure if they are, but we can follow up on that. And I just want to comment. I think you're absolutely right about, we have to think about the long term, keep our eyes on the future, that even if there's way more people sitting on the bench looking for jobs right now, that will change. It will change and we'll move forward. And so we need people to be ready for those jobs. And so it's really important to keep moving that forward, those training opportunities, I think. But, of course, in the meantime, people have to pay the rent and buy the groceries. So I know it's a struggle. So thanks for that, those comments.
Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, two more brief points, if we may.
Please.
Okay. In terms of the outreach, there was a lot of discussion in this committee, as well as other committees, about the $500,000 in outreach funds to low-income communities, communities of color, communities across greater Minnesota. We heard today from the Offices of Energy Security that those contracts are still in negotiation. Because of that, the names of those awardees cannot be announced. And we would be very interested, if not today, but very soon, to have the Office of Energy Security describe the proposals they got to reach those communities and the expertise that the awardees have in actually reaching those communities. That would be of interest to us, as well as if there were organizations that applied for those funds that are actually from some of those communities and if they got those awards or not. Those are very important to us. The final piece I wanted to talk to you about today is reporting and accountability, why we're here today. And so, if I may, I just want to read you really quickly the two sentences of language that were actually in the piece of legislation we passed. This report requires a complete accounting of the number of jobs retained or created by each project, including data on hiring from communities experiencing high rates of unemployment, including but not limited to low-income, rural, tribal communities, and communities of color. As we heard Mr. Davis testify, that's fairly clear language as to what's required, and Mr. Davis also testified that they could collect that data quite easily. I want to refer you really quickly to Attachment E in the OES report. If you look at page 10 of Attachment E, there's a page entitled Actual Hiring Outcomes. That's the name of this page. Ms. Streff referred to this page as the summaries that some of the community action programs submitted to describe how they did or did not achieve this goal. And I just want to read a couple of the shortest ones briefly to you, if that's okay. One example, this is a complete answer to this reporting requirement, and I quote, "Our advertisements for contractors in 18 various media resources listed targeted qualifications required of contractors. We were able to award contracts to all contractors who met eligibility requirements as advertised." That's the entire report on whether or not they met these goals. One more for you. If you turn to page 12 and you look about two-thirds of the way down the page, this is another complete report of whether or not this organization met those goals. Used joint RFP process with other metro weatherization service providers. That's the entire answer to whether or not they met the hiring goals listed in this legislation. Madam Chair, Senators, I'm hoping we can all agree that this is not an acceptable report. Almost every other state agency in the state collects regularly demographic data. They report that data. There are many models of how to do that that we would be glad to share with the senators or the office on how other departments do this. This isn't okay. We worked too hard on this bill for this kind of reporting, and this community has showed up dozens of times, and they deserve better than this. So I just want to conclude our testimony by thanking you, Madam Chair, for your continued leadership, Senators, for your continued commitment to making sure that the communities you see here today can participate in these opportunities, and we would, of course, be willing to answer any other questions you might have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bauer, and thanks for reminding us what we put into our law, because you're right, this doesn't get there.
And I would be very interested to see what other agencies do in terms of reporting. I actually, you know, am not that familiar with what is routine. And I think we should all sort of look at that for comparison purposes to see what's possible and should be expected of all of our.
Madam Chair, we'd be glad to send some of those materials to you and also to the other senators on the committee.
Thank you. That would be great. Are there any other questions? Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make a comment, Mr. King and Mr. Davis, with regards to the incredible diversity that you bring to this room today and how much I appreciate your effort to bring really a perspective to the Senate and to us in the legislature about the need to really do a better job of bringing minority communities here. I oftentimes find myself with one or two other members of minority communities here. So this is, I feel great about being in this room today, and I appreciate that you have done this. My question to you is, Mr. Bauer and Mr. King, I am quite concerned that this is a temporary effort, and I am concerned that this money is a one-time effort that maybe next year if I come here, you just will not be here. And I don't know what's going to happen to these individuals who have been trained to do the jobs, and then we don't have the money to do it. And so my question to you is, what is the plan that we have in place for the next phase? What are we going to do with all the people that we're training? Because this money is going to be gone. So where do we go from here?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Torres Ray, Summit Academy OIC is an accredited vocational training school, not simply a program. Therefore, we're taking our weatherization technician training and integrating it into our full curriculum. We recognize that the weatherization market in the private sector has not taken off yet. Therefore, our approach is to ensure that each person that's trained as a carpenter in their basic skill set, in their tool belt, will be the techniques required to help with energy efficiency. So this this one-time funding, which we will benefit directly at Summit of about $125,000 after we pay out other expenses, will help us to kick that program off. But our goal is to integrate this into everything that we do through the core. And one other comment, the reason we bring our students here also so that they can understand their role in participating as active citizens, and that this is about them and their families and communities, and if they're not a part of the decision-making process, then we will see what has occurred in the rearview mirror rather than having an active hand in getting it done. So we intend to sustain the effort by fully integrating it and to ensure that the efforts of the future represent the interests of our people by educating them on the process and involving them so that they can advocate on their own behalf and ensure that the resources are appropriately and fairly allocated.
And Madam Chair, Senator Torres Ray, if I may, also speaking about just hire more broadly, all these folks who have come down here time and again, you know, we started this around the stimulus money because that was timely and there was a lot of it and there was a lot of talk about that. But the state of Minnesota makes public investments all the time. We have a bonding bill this session. There are plenty of these investments, and we intend to be here and apply the same principles that we were successful in applying to the stimulus money to all public investments. And so I think as long as that's going on, you're going to keep seeing hearing rooms like this. We'll be here.
All right. Well, thank you for your presence and for all of your work. We appreciate that, and hopefully we'll continue to strive for accountability and progress. I guess that's how I'll end. Thank you very much. Members will, on Tuesday, we'll be taking public testimony on the governor's budget. So everyone is welcome to that. Meeting's adjourned.
Yeah, the person not going to testify at the last meeting?
No, she struck her name. Sorry, I forgot to mention that. Thank you.
That's kind of telling.
Yeah, I had it crossed off, so I didn't mention it.
I was trying to get some reports on the legacy that you've done and shown your accountability.
I was wondering, because last time she testified, she said how great the program was, how fast the program was.
Lack of staff, lack of imagination.
They have to reallocate. They may want to put money back.
Direction from the governor, but
maybe they didn't want her to say that. I have no idea.